Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for June's Orthopaedics Club webinar. I'm very pleased to introduce you to our speaker for today, European and ORZVS specialist in small animal surgery, Heidi Radke. Thank you, Heidi. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Thank you very much, Ema, for that kind introduction. Thank you to the attendees. A warm welcome to this afternoon's webinar on assessing and treating common calcaneal tendinopathies. At the end of this webinar, you should be able to accurately diagnose dogs with various forms of common calcaneal tendinopathies. You should be able to discuss the decision-making process and possible treatment options with patient owners. You should also be able to outline a rehabilitation plan for dogs with common calcaneal tendinopathies, and you should be able to describe how to address common complications associated with the treatment of common calcaneal tendinopathies. The common calcaneal tendon is the strongest tendon in the body, and very high forces act on it. In people athletes, pain associated with strain is very common and is called Achilles tendon syndrome. In dogs, the frequency of common calcaneal tendinopathies depends on the lifestyle and the breed of the dog. It's more frequently in very active dogs, for example, dogs which do agility, and it's also more often seen in certain breeds. It is also called the Achilles tendon, and it's interesting to know why that is the case. Achilles was a great warrior, and it's part of the Greek mythology, and his body was rendered invulnerable by his mom, who dipped him into the river Styx. And she held him on his heel, and that was the only part which remained vulnerable. In the end, he was killed by a poisoned dart into his heel. So in the 17th century, a Dutch anatomist used the term Achilles tendon the first time for this particular tendon. And it's thought that it also refers to the particular fact that injury to this tendon is very disabling and painful. And with that, we stay in the area of anatomy for a little bit longer. And I would like to ask you now, which tendons form the common calcaneal tendon? Is it A, the tendon of the paired gastrocnemius and the superficial digital flexor tendon, or B, the tendon of the paired gastrocnemius, the superficial digital flexor tendon, and the deep digital flexor tendon? Or is it C, the tendon of the paired gastrocnemius, the superficial digital flexor tendon, and the common tendon of the biceps, gracilis, and semitendinosus? Or is it D, the superficial digital flexor tendon, the deep digital flexor tendon, and the tendon of the biceps femoris? And yes, it is C, the three tendons, the paired gastrocnemius, the superficial digital flexor tendon, and the common tendon of the biceps, gracilis, and semitendinosus form the common calcaneal tendon. If you don't know, then apparently it's always good to pick C, because there seems to be a statistically significant higher likelihood that C is the correct answer. Just a side tip for other multiple choice questionnaires. So here we have it, the common calcaneal tendon formed by these three tendons, two of them, the gastrocnemius tendon and the common tendon of the biceps femoris, gracilis, and semitendinosus attach at the calcaneus. Whereas the superficial digital flexor tendon attaches on the calcaneus, but then it runs also over the calcaneus down to the phalanges and attaches then onto the second row of the phalanges. And that's important to know because that's very relevant for the clinical presentation, and we will talk about this in more detail later. Here you see a drawing outlining the position of the three tendons to each other and how that changes depending on the level. So we're looking at the tendon from the caudal aspect, and on the left side is lateral and on the right side is medial. The gastrocnemius tendon is gray. The superficial digital flexor tendon is black and the common tendon is white. And we look now at the moment only at the most distal aspect, this one here, and you see directly at the calcaneus, the superficial digital flexor tendon is the most caudal tendon with the common tendon attaching medially to the olecranon, to the calcaneus. And we look a little bit further down onto the tendons on a histological level. And here you see the calcaneal tuber on the left side. And we can recognize there that there are several fibrocartilages embedded in the tendons. And you see them on the numbers 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. They are responsible for a smooth gliding of the tendons, and number 3 at the direct attachment of the gastrocnemius tendon allows a gradual attachment to the bone. A typical feature of fibrocartilage is that it's poorly vascularized, and it's also able to withstand a lower tensile load. And these points have been linked to rupture because peak loading accumulates in these areas. Under the tendon, directly on the calcaneus, here with the marked FP, is the calcaneal bursa, which is filled with a fat pad, and that protects the tendons from direct pressure on the calcaneal tuber. And once again, we go a little bit deeper into the structure, and on a structural level, we see that the tendon tissue has a multi-unit structure composed of the fibril-forming type 1 collagen molecules, and they form individual subfascicles and fascicles, and then these group of fascicles then form the body of the functional tendon. Tendon healing is slow because of the low vascularization, what I already just said. But also the healing process can be complicated by the fact that the tendon tends to create adhesions with the surrounding tissues, and that restricts mobility. There's also a tendency that the tendon will retract when injured, and that again can provoke the building of fibrous tissue and adhesions. And just to briefly state the term tendinopathies, what exactly that means. Literally, it means any disease or disorder of a tendon, and it's used to describe any problem involving a tendon, and that means for our common calcaneal tendon, it includes inflammatory processes, degenerative processes, but also complete and partial traumatic ruptures. The etiology can be traumatic or atraumatic. When we look at traumatic cases, then we can either have an impact injury that usually results in an avulsion of the tendon from the calcaneus and quite frequently active, for instance, agility dogs are affected by that. Other reasons to have a traumatic common calcaneal tendinopathy could be from direct sharp trauma to the musculotendinous unit, a cut or even a laceration. And there have been reports that, for instance, injuries associated with radiators, so when the dog lies under the radiator and gets up, then the tendon can get cut. Or I've seen several cases of tendon cuts when dogs accompany people, their owners, to go skiing or snowboarding, and then they get injured by the skis or snowboard. So that's similar. An atraumatic etiology is related with a chronic degeneration of the Achilles tendon. And that most frequently is related with a repetitive microtrauma. However, it can also have other underlying reasons like systemic disease. And that's very important to recognize, and we need to exclude that. In particular, in cats, endocrinologies play a role, like diabetes or Cushing's, for example. It has also been reported to be provoked by iatrogenic causes, for instance, corticosteroid injection. The three grades of tendon strains are grade 1, 2, and 3. Grade 1 is defined as an overstretching of the tendon without a tear or loss of function. And this means we have a simple stretch which can lead to some thickening of the tendon or some inflammation, but there is minimal structural involvement. So we have tears only on a microscopic level, there's no fiber disruption, and we have an overall intact architecture. Grade 2 strain means that the general continuity of the tendon is intact, but the strength is significantly reduced. And we may see here minor fiber disruption that with a partial tear or a co-lesion. That's particularly important for ultrasound examination, and we will get to that later. We may have minor or partial instability or laxity, and it's usually painful. A grade 3 strain is then a complete disruption or avulsion or tearing of the tendon. And here we will find a complete tear with gross tendon dysfunction. And not to mix up strain with sprain, whereas strain means injury to a tendon or muscle, sprain means a ligament. A tendon injury can be complete or partial, as we've just seen with these categories. In the common calcaneal tendon, a complete rupture concerns all three parts of the tendon, whereas a partial rupture can also concern all three parts of a tendon. And one investigation from last year, from Gamble, Canap, and Canap, showed that just over half of the dogs had injured, in partial injuries, all three parts of the tendon. Whereas the other half, or just a little bit over 40%, so a little bit less, they had the superficial digital flexor tendon intact, and only the gastrocnemius and the common tendon were affected by the partial rupture. They also looked at which level of the common calcaneal tendon the injury happened, and the vast majority, over 77%, had a direct avulsion or an injury just above the calcaneus, with around 10% having an injury at the musculotendinous junction, here the yellow arrow, and 12%, so not much more, had an injury at the somewhere of in between the other two. When we look at complete and partial tears, we can also look at traumatic and atraumatic or more acute and more chronic injuries. And there we can find that traumatic or acute injuries have a tendency to be complete tendon ruptures, but a smaller number can also be partial ruptures. Whereas looking at atraumatic or chronic injuries, the majority tends to have a partial rupture, but sometimes they can also be complete. And then there's also the possibility that we have an atraumatic chronic degeneration of the tendon, which then suddenly becomes an acute case, an acute deterioration, and that could still be partial, but also complete. Moitzstege in 1993 suggested a grading system for Achilles tendinopathies in dogs, which has three types, but it's never really come in use very much. And this has to do, in my opinion, with the fact that the type 2, when you look at that, that defines the lengthened Achilles tendon system. There are three subgroups, and subgroup C is definitely an important one, but A and B don't seem to reflect clinical relevant cases. So this is something which one would need to, I think, adjust to our current knowledge. As I already said, several breeds have been reported to be more frequently affected by, in particular, chronic degeneration of the common calcaneal tendon. And Sandra Kaur report is one of them who reported them, for example, but also others. And Doberman, Border Collies, and Labradors are usually amongst the most frequently affected breeds. Clinically, the signs of an injury to the common calcaneal tendon can vary. Many animals will be lame with a variable amount of swelling. Sometimes we have an even visible disruption. But because the tendon is such an important joint extensor, we usually or often have a joint dysfunction which can be quite obvious. And here we see an example. What breed is that? Well, of course, this is not a dog. This is a cat with a complete disruption of the left calcaneal tendon. And that shows then the typical appearance of a plantigrade stance with a dropped hock, totally flat-footed. And that looks exactly the same in a dog. Here, a border collie with also a left complete rupture of the common calcaneal tendon. And that means there is no extension of the tarsus possible. More varied, we will see clinical signs with incomplete ruptures, with more chronic degenerations. Here's an example of a case. Usually we have some swelling. You see here on the right calcaneus, just above, there's swelling of the tendon visible. In the hock may be dropped, which is not so obvious in this case, really. But you see that the dog is offloading the leg, so it's shifting leg to the weight to the other side, and it's clearly uncomfortable. And here we have the video of Milo. And when he's actually walking, one can appreciate that there is some dropping of the hock. So this is more a dynamic procedure, a dynamic effect when there is weight bearing. We just have a look once again when he's closer to us. And here one can appreciate that there is some dropping of the right hock. Not so obvious on the standing dog, the dropping of the hock, just a little bit. But another finding is there, which is very typical, which can be very typical. And this is this curling of the toes, a so-called crab claw stance, like the animal is trying to grip the floor. And this has to do with the fact that the function of the superficial digital flexor tendon is still intact. But because there is some more flexion of the hock, the tendon has to travel a longer distance than it normally would do, and that pulls the toes in a flex position. Here we have another example, which is much more extreme, with a clearly dropped hock, and this has to do with a dysfunction of the gastrocnemius tendon. However, the superficial flexor, digital flexor tendon, is still intact and is traveling a longer distance and therefore is curling the toes. And if you look onto the other side, it's also the case on the other side. So this is a bilaterally affected Doberman. So the clinical presentation and the orthopedic examination, they are often indicative of a dysfunction of the common calcaneal tendon. So what further workup is required? What would you do after having assessed an animal like this? We want to exclude any underlying disease, as we had already discussed, but also for the tendon, we want to have some more information. We want to exclude other injuries, and we want to be able to grade the tendinopathy. So taking radiographs will enable us to assess the bones and the soft tissues to some degree. You can see here an example where there is clear swelling of the common calcaneal tendon visible. But we also want to exclude any bony changes. And it's always recommended to take radiographs of the other side. So this is the same dog, the right side on the right, and there we can see the common calcaneal tendon appears normal in size, but we can also see that there are some signs of joint degeneration, there's some new bone formation on the caudal aspect, but also on the medial aspect of the tarsus. And that's important to know for the overall assessment of the patient. Here's another example with mineralization, various areas of mineralization in the common calcaneal tendon. And that's very typical. And that's an expression of this repetitive microtrauma acting in the various structures of the tendon, which then leads to dystrophic mineralization of the tendon. Here's the dog on the left side we've just looked at, and on the right side is another example, also with some bony structure. What do you think is the difference of these two cases? I look at the left one a little bit closer, and there we see the dystrophic mineralization, but we also see the proximal aspect of the calcaneus. And that looks very different to this dog on the right side, where it's much smoother, and this gives us a suggestion that this is actually an avulsion of the tendon, a bony avulsion. And this is something we want to know before we plan any treatment, because a bony avulsion can potentially be reopposed with the typical technique of using K-wires and a tension band wire if the bony aspect, the bony fragment is large enough, which is questionable probably in this case. And then ultrasound has become a mainstay of working up dogs with a common calcaneal tendinopathy. It's very useful for assessing the structures of the tendon. In particular, this longitudinal view, which we see here, can help us with that. And you see here from the top to the bottom is the superficial digital flexor tendon. Then in the middle we have the gastrocnemius tendon, and the common tendon is just a fine strand on the distal aspect. On the right side, you see the outline of the calcaneus, and directly in front of it is the bursa located. So here we now have a clinical example. Again, this dog of which we already have seen the radiograph a little bit earlier. And on the ultrasound, now here it would be the calcaneus to the left side of the ultrasound. And there we can see there is a clear disorganization. We can't appreciate the normal structure of the tendon in big parts. However, the superficial digital flexor tendon on top of that is still visible with the longitudinal tendon fibers. So that's important to know. And this will help us significantly in our further planning for treating this dog. Here's another example of a dog with a tendinopathy, and this is also a good example demonstrating how important good quality radiographs are, because in this case we are not only interested in the bony structures, but we really want to see the soft tissue structures as good as possible. So this here is overexposed, and therefore we don't see the soft tissue structures really well. We can then, on digital radiographs, of course, play around a little bit with contrast and make that more visible, but it's not optimal. So that's the left side, and when we compare that with the right side, one can appreciate that the tendon is a little bit thickened and there's no obvious new bone formation. But with ultrasound, really, we can compare the different structures very, very well. And here we see right and left side comparing. The right tendon is on the left of the screen, and the left, so the thickened, affected side, is on the right side of the screen. In both images is the calcaneus to the left. And we see that the gastrocnemius tendon is thickened on the affected side. Is also the structure is a little bit irregular, whereas the superficial digital flexor tendon on both sides looks intact and relatively similar. And when we look a little bit closer onto the left, so the affected side, we can also detect that there is some fluid accumulation, which gives us a further indication that there is a more acute process going on with inflammation at the moment. So we need a good clinical assessment with a proper orthopedic examination. We want to exclude systemic disease, and then for imaging, radiographs, and ultrasound in particular, will be very helpful to assess them in more detail. That brings us to treatment options. In cases of a complete rupture, which is often traumatic and acute, the situation is relatively straightforward because the recommended treatment is surgical repair of the damaged tendon. And then to get the tendon to heal, we need to immobilize the talocrural joint in extension. This means we relax the tendon as much as possible because the tendon cannot heal under tension. Of course, we need to consider that there are certain challenges when suturing a tendon. We want to avoid placing sutures parallel to the tendon because that will easily tear through the tissue. And we want to oppose the tendon perfectly without or with a minimal gap. That should really not be more than 2 to 3 millimeters. Otherwise, we will have fibrous tissue forming there and that will weaken the tendon significantly. And we want to place a suture which obstructs minimally the local blood supply. And there are several suture patterns available to achieve all this. The three loop pulley, which you can see here on the left, there the first suture is anchored at three different levels, and then each stitch is placed in 60 degrees, displaced from the previous one. That works very well. Or we see here the locking loop in the center that also achieves a good apposition. It will have an effect of constricting the blood supply at the actual little loops. And interestingly, it has also been shown that the continuous cruciate suture is a good choice because that achieves a good apposition, it relieves tension, and it has been shown to be superior to the locking loop. So this is a good, quick, easy suture technique, in particular for flat tendons. And then in the surgery, we usually do a caudolateral approach to the calcaneus, which is then extended proximally as needed. And in case of an avulsion of the tendon directly from the bone, we need then a modification of a tendon suture because we need to anchor the tendon back to the bone. And you see that here in the center in that drawing. Here is an example of using a locking loop, but this modification can also be used with different tendon sutures. And then additional sutures can be placed to improve the tendon apposition. What suture material should we use? Definitely something monofilament to glide smoothly through the tendon and avoid irritation. And there we can either use a non-absorbable suture material or a slowly absorbable suture material. So proline or PDS would be adequate. Why? Something which stays there quite long because the tendon heals very slowly, as we had already said earlier. And it's also recommended to use not particularly large suture sizes because that could negatively act onto the healing process by increasing the tissue reaction. What do we do when we have a gap? That can be challenging, and it's good to know what options are available and to plan surgery accordingly. There are several tendon lengthening methods, like a sliding Z-plasty or a V2Y plasty, which we see here in this drawing, or a so-called accordion technique. All of these require a relatively large tendon. So in smaller dogs, these might not be adequate. And then we need to think about different techniques, for instance, using additional techniques to bridge the gap. And that could be the use of proline mesh, for example, as you can see here in the photo on the right side. It has been reported to use fascia lata or porcine intestinal submucosa. That's already several years ago. More recent reports have been looking into the use of allografts, which are commercially available even in some parts of the world. And it's also been reported to use a synthetic ligament enforcement. Here that was in VCOD 2015. Which is then anchored to the calcaneus with an interference screw. So there are several options available. There are also options which can be used as a backup technique, even if you haven't planned to have to use something, and this is to use a muscle transposition technique. For instance, a transposition of the deep digital flexor tendon or the caudal belly of the sartorius has been used, or the lateral portion of the semitendinosus. And these can be also very useful methods to reinforce a tendon, in particular when there is a gap. Much more complicated is the situation when we have a partial, so these typical atraumatic chronic ruptures, because then the question is much more difficult to answer: should there be any surgical repair of the damaged tendons? One approach could be not to touch the tendon, not do anything with them, and only immobilize the joint in extension, the tarsal joint in extension, and in the hope that the tendons can heal by themselves. And the decision making if the tendon should be repaired or not is really, there is really helpful to have an ultrasound examination and get a very good idea of the exact level and extent of affection of the three different parts of tendon. And there, it's also important to consider possibilities to further stimulate the healing. And here we're looking at the area of using regenerative medicine in the treatment of our dogs. And that means the use of platelet-rich plasma or stem cells, with the idea that they are both rich in growth factors. And these growth factors can enhance the regeneration of the tendon and can, by doing that, facilitate the tissue repair. There is, in using regenerative medicine, there is most evidence out there for the healing of tendon and muscle injuries. And this is in people, this is in horses, in dogs. There are still only very limited numbers there, but overall, the use for this purpose is there's the strongest evidence for that. It can be injected under ultrasound control, so it doesn't require necessarily open surgery. And that is certainly an area where we will for sure hear more of in the future. Another challenge can be, particularly in these chronically affected cases, and we see an example here, is when there are other orthopedic problems present. And then it can be difficult to distinguish and to decide which is the most clinically relevant problem at this moment. For instance, in this dog, Rascal has a left common calcaneal tendinopathy, but also a partial cruciate ligament rupture on the left side and some lumbar pain. So in a case like this, then it's necessary to do repeat examinations to distinguish between the clinical relevance of the individual problems. And in this particular dog, the Achilles tendinopathy was treated conservatively by resting the dog while it had stifle surgery, and that had a very good outcome. So now I'd like to talk a little bit more in detail about the immobilization of the tibiotarsal joint in extension, because as I said, this is required in practically all cases, no matter if they will have open surgery or not. And we do have different options to do that, and each of them comes with their own pros and cons. One possibility is using a calcaneal tibial screw, and that is usually left in place for 4 to 6 weeks. In dogs, we usually use a 4.5 millimeter cortical screw. Cats can also be used in cats with a 2 millimeter cortical screw, and they need to be placed very accurately because the calcaneus is narrow. And also, it's important to remember that it's offset a little bit laterally, so the screw needs to be directed a little bit medially to be properly placed. It's not, and here we see it can be used also with open surgery, so can be used as a standalone conservative treatment or in combination with open surgery. And here's an example of a chronic tendinopathy which had open surgery and removal of scar and fibrous tissue with a tenorrhaphy, and that's a 6 week post-operative radiograph where one can see that the tendon structure, just the appearance on the radiographs, has significantly changed and more normalized. And of course, we would also do an ultrasound to assess that further. It's not uncommon to have complications. These screws, and that's not surprising because it's only one screw holding that in place. So they can break, and therefore we do leave them long so that we are able to remove both parts still in case that would happen. Here's an example where the screw has bent. That also needs to be removed, then that will cause pain, that is loose. So complications can be avoided in the first place or minimized by proper screw placement, and then precautions can be taken that one can deal with possible complications properly. Another possibility to hold the tarsus in extension is the use of a transarticular external skeletal fixator. That can be relatively easily applied. On the left side, you see an example in a dog. On the right side is our cat again, we've seen earlier with the acute rupture. On the left side, if you look closely, you might be wondering what these little metal clips are there. These are crimp clamps, and this is a dog which actually had a medial collateral ligament injury, and that's the reason for this dog to have a transarticular external fixator. But the principle is the same, to hold the tarsus while the soft tissue structures are healing. Very frequently we see complications with these transarticular external fixators. The complications are usually benign and we can deal with them, but we need to inform owners about that. And that can be pin tract discharge, pin tract infection, or pin loosening. Also best avoided by placing a proper transarticular fixator strong enough in the first place, but if it occurs, then we can deal with it by cleaning around it, taking swabs, giving antibiotics, or replacing loose pins. More serious complications like bone fractures can usually be avoided by applying a properly suited fixator in the first place. These are linear fixators. They don't have to be linear. One can use circular fixators, or one can hybrid fixators, a combination of linear and circular. Another possibility, and that is a quite interesting one, which has become more available in more recent years, and that's the use of to hold the leg in the tarsus in extension, and this is the use of an orthotic brace. Orthotic braces, these type of braces, they are custom made, they are highly adjustable, and they can be fixed in an extended position with a special screw. And then one can allow more and more flexion and also mobility during the recovery period. This is how these custom made braces are made. One takes a little cast with some plastic foil around it, and then this cut off. It's not very complicated, but one needs a little bit of practice because it's very important that this is done absolutely accurately, because if it doesn't fit, then one can have horrible complications with pressure sores. The other interesting thing is not only that we can allow more movement during the rehabilitation period, but when one can also use a smaller version. So that's the same brace, but one has removed then the foot part, and that's then a version which can be used also for exercise in the future as a precaution to overloading the tendon. As I said, brace-related complications can be possible, and that can be then very dramatic because you really don't want to leave the dog without a brace. And here, this little brown cloth you can see underneath is an absolute brilliant silicone wrap, which can be used in case there should be a pressure sore, and this is really a lifesaver. That works very well. So we need to hold the limb in extension and protect the tendon during healing, no matter if we do surgery or not. Apart from a custom-made orthotic brace, one can also use more conventional casts or splints, but they have a even much higher risk of having pressure sores, and that can be very challenging to maintain that for several weeks. The tendon, during healing, it has a little increase in strength for the first 3 to 4 weeks. But then from week 3 to 6, it increases to withstand 50% of the load of a normal tendon. And that is definitely enough for slow walking. For that, we usually need 30%. So that means during that time, we need limb immobilization in joint extension, which unfortunately comes with disadvantages. Because when a joint doesn't move, we get signs of cartilage degeneration. That can lead to joint stiffness, ligament laxity. So these are negative consequences of the limb immobilization we want to try to counteract. And this can be done by passive range of motion exercises and early mobilizations. And immobilization techniques which allow this can be advantageous. And this is the possibility with an orthotic brace, which can easily be taken off. External fixator, one can loosen clamps or have an articulated one, which could also offer this option. So that means usually we need 4 to 6 weeks of rigid immobilization and rest. And then from week 6 to 12, we're looking at a gradual return to normal exercise with the aim that by week 16, the dog should ideally be back to normal exercise. So that is quite a long period of time, and that's important to tell our owners that in the first place. And as I just outlined, that's why it's so important to think about accompanying physiotherapy to counteract these negative aspects of holding that joint in extension. And therefore, any dog treated with a common calcaneal tendinopathy should really have a very, very close follow-up with a physiotherapist and also hydrotherapy. In particular, underwater treadmill hydrotherapy is here very useful. And these are important things to discuss with owners because, of course, that requires a certain level of commitment and compliance from these owners. Again, ultrasound is useful also for serial examination of the tendon. We can assess tendon healing. Here's an example of a post-operative situation, so we can detect the suture material, of course, in there. But we can see that the tendon structure already starts to normalize, and that is then helpful to know how to adjust our post-operative plan to that. So in summary, there is a very high risk of complications associated with the technique of immobilization, but we can deal with them normally very well. Then there are other complications possible. For instance, that the tendon doesn't heal as we anticipate, or the signs of tendinopathy and tendon dysfunction reoccur. Here we see our case, which we had assessed already initially again, as well with the dystrophic mineralization. And then we see directly postoperatively, and then the 6 weeks postoperatively, and we can see that the tendon is still swollen and the mineralization is even increasing, which could also be a sign that the processes are still ongoing, the degeneration is still ongoing. And indeed, once this screw was removed, the tendon was still highly dysfunctional. And this is then a case where considering a salvage procedure comes into play. And the salvage procedure is here in this case a pan-tarsal arthrodesis, here with a medially applied plate, but one could of course also use a more traditional cranially applied plate. And this can also be a valid option. So the overall prognosis is, despite a relatively high complication rate, which is in most cases associated with the method of immobilization of the joint, is actually, and surprisingly, and that's the good news, good for return to function. And this is for the vast majority of cases. So this is also important and a good motivation to owners. However, this is only true when we assess our patients carefully and detect the ones early which will not do well, to then advise for them a salvage procedure earlier on. So in summary, we've spoken about the anatomy of the common calcaneal tendon, that it has three parts with the paired gastrocnemius tendon, the most important one, and the superficial digital flexor tendon, the important one which crosses the calcaneus and therefore is the one responsible for curling the toes in cases of partial rupture. One needs to distinguish between acute and chronic and complete and partial tendinopathies. That is very, very important and plays a big role in planning treatment for these animals. For the workup, our orthopedic examination is essential, and diagnostic imaging using radiographs, but also in particular ultrasound, is very helpful. We need to consider all treatment options once we have that particular animal worked up properly to decide, does it need surgical treatment? In all cases, we need to have some form of immobilization of the joint, and regenerative medicine is something which can be considered very relevantly in these cases. Very important is to do a good rehabilitation program, ideally with a professional physiotherapist on board. And we need to be ready to deal with complications, mainly associated with the immobilization method, which is usually possible when we act early on. And with this, I thank you for your attention, and I hope you feel ready to approach, diagnose, and treat your next case of common calcaneal tendinopathy. And I'm very happy to answer any questions. Don't hesitate to contact me. Thank you very much.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Heidi for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.